Welcome to the Friday Workplace Briefing. Workplace law changes so quickly. Tune in weekly to find out how the law is changing and what you need to do.
G'day, Kim.
Hi, Andrew. How are you going?
God, you love these days.
Yeah, I'm sorry you're stuck with me again this week.
No,
Poor Nina's sick.
I'm very excited to have you here, but I know this is not your favourite activity.
No, it's not. Anyway, moving on.
Look, I think we've got a workers' comp seminar coming up, but in the new legislation that's been agreed by the Liberals and Labor, hidden in the back of this is this horrible clause that allows the OHS regulator to look into the backyard of the workers' comp regulator and see what has been written.
Which is never done before.
No, it's always been a barrier. But, of course, when we're looking at things like rejecting claims, particularly when you're going to get a circumstance investigator, and John Darcy, thanks for again raising this for me.
Yeah.
We have to be very careful about what we do, what we admit to, because when we're looking at particularly sharp and difficult psychological claims or serious injury, what that circumstance investigator in the psychological injury part will do, or what your notes will disclose in relation to a serious injury like OHS person doing a root cause analysis which puts you in jail, they're not good things to do. So this has to be a much more reflective process now. You go with it, Kim.
Well, so what we obviously, we reject or try to reject a lot of psych claims, and when there is that sort of level of risk, what I will generally do is I will speak to the witnesses and provide our statements to the circumstances investigator appointed by the agent. And they will invariably accept them without then needing to go back and interview the witnesses. So it just provides us with that level of protection against making those disclosures.
Yeah, and look, it does things, like it's right down to what is your response form, what do you say? Mm-hmm. When these things happen, I want you to stop and think. I guess that's what I really want to do. Yeah. And then I want you to think, is there a risk of liability? Pick up a phone and speak to Kim, because that's not a cost, and say, look, what do you think? But I want a very deliberate process that cleanses the evidence that sits on that for two reasons. One, it goes to the regulator. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the complainant has the entitlement to get the documents that you've created and go off and run a common law claim. So that risk was always there for the common law part of the claim. It's now there for sending you off to jail. So can we just understand this is a very bad piece of legislation which was done with sleight of hand, okay? It's much worse than what people say. It is the worst part of the entire package.
Yeah.
And you need to reflect, think, prepare and be deliberate in your responses to it.
Yeah.
That's not on for today, by the way. I just thought I'd add that one in.
Yeah, well, we will be having a masterclass on the 1st of May to talk about workers' comp, so we'll cover off on that in more detail then.
Okay, goody good. Yeah. Look, let's kick on to intractable bargaining, okay? We've now got a couple of cases that have come through. We've got the most recent one, which is the firefighters case, and then I think it's called
Cleanaway
case. We've given you the case numbers for both of these for a couple of reasons. Intractable bargaining comes through in closing loop number two. And what it means is, unlike the Murdoch University case where the old version of intractable bargaining was used, wasn't called that, but it was used, and the university swept away an enterprise agreement that existed in the past and fell back onto the award. So the new intractable bargaining says you can't be worse off than what you were before. The firefighters, as always, have these crazy disputes that go on forever with the Victorian government. There's already been an audit made, and now the firefighters are trying to stop it by saying, no, everything wasn't agreed. And by the way, there's now this new piece of legislation in, so they're off to the federal court to try and get it rejected, and not surprisingly, Victorian government saying, no, the deal. In this case, what it shows, as with the next case, is there is a lack of clarity about what has been agreed and what is not agreed. When you're in intractable bargaining, what Kim and I have got to say is we are unable to agree on things despite a protracted bargaining process. You're dealing with people who hate each other, okay? You're dealing with people who want to have a fight.
Mm.
And the temptation is to allow each person to control documents, to each person to make allegations which are not true, and let them float through. The rule of bargaining is really simple. Money is last, okay? Mm. That's the rule.
Yeah.
And what you do is you set up a process to lay down parts of things which are agreed along the way which show it's not intractable. Now, remember, from the employer's point of view, the longer the bargain goes on, the longer it is before you've got to pay anything extra. So you shouldn't be in a rush.
Yeah.
Okay? You shouldn't feel compelled to do anything. And this is what really happened with Cleanaway. You know, Cleanaway is another case where this time the Fair Work Commission had some real round 15 of negotiations, the Commission had a real sensitivity towards where Cleanaway were at. But there's bargaining agents and they're saying, we've got to get everyone to talk about where we are. We've got to find out all this information. So what is a dispute stretches days in a tribunal, agitating over facts which are all disputed. When you do an enterprise bargaining, your person creates notes at the end of the day which it circulates, which will never be criticised until you get to court. It's too late. Okay, can I just say it's too late? It's contemporaneous evidence.
Yeah.
It's evidence of the truth. So control the document flow. Control that have the communication system that goes straight to the floor so people know the truth. Have a document that says agreed, not agreed for future discussion. So that all the way along, as you agree, it shows it's agreed. Now, you'll have some fights about it, but can I just say to you, if you don't adopt that simple methodology, in a major case, we have a difficult union and you're left in this long-standing dispute. Don't rush for conclusion. Document correctly. Money's always last.
Yeah.
That's the only issue that comes out of all these cases. So I just thought we'd use them as a bit of a way of highlighting how much you can stuff up an enterprise agreement by making it bureaucratic and not go back to the basics. Right, look, let's jump on, okay? I think we're going to go to, is it May in the Commonwealth or no, Chitura next year?
So this is the guy who, the truck driver, was drug affected and killed the four police officers. But now instead of, this case is talking about the supervisor who was charged under the heavy vehicle national law, not under safety law, which is a lesser.
Well, it's not as well resourced, I think, is the short answer. Yeah. And what happened to this supervisor? The supervisor had been put on notice there was something wrong with this guy.
Yeah.
By another driver. This is an industry where people don't talk about this sort of stuff. He'd actually spoken to the guy who said some weird stuff that anybody listened to would go, wow, that's weird stuff. I know he's got strange religious beliefs, but that's really weird.
Yeah.
And then got him to do a couple of jobs and they come back to assess him. Can I just say, if this guy ended up with 200 hours of community service, if this guy was under OHS or WHS legislation in South Australia, Victoria, Queensland, where this is an underwhelming case, can I say? It's got some judicial and political issues that sat around the initial charges, which I think made everyone roll over and just take it easy. But if this was a safety prosecution run correctly, this supervisor's knowledge of risk was so high and the failure to intervene and, in fact, the deliberate direction to do work and to come back and assist, given the knowledge, actually doesn't make it at the low end, 200 community hours.
Mm.
It puts it up the really high end because this guy is driving a weapon. Okay, this isn't a person who's going out on the floor and sweeping with a broom. This person is driving a great big truck.
Mm.
It is a weapon. Yeah. And that's how a court looks at it. So this is not a good decision. It's not well argued and it's an underwhelming decision at the end of it. Put in the hands of people who fight safety every day at a high level, I think it would have been run differently. Take away the politics if it weren't policemen who are involved, all those sort of issues which make a court just cringe as it hands a decision down. Do that, this guy would have been in jail.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to say, when you're on notice, when a reasonable person is on notice at risk, your obligation is to intervene.
Mm.
And yes, this is a reckless endangerment, knew the risk of serious injury or death, and did nothing for it, was careless about it. But this was more. The supervisor had real existent knowledge of immediate risk and actually directed them to go and do something that placed them at risk. I think it's a stunning, and it's, as I said, stunning decision.
Yeah,
okay. And we go to May in the Commonwealth, which is the case about reasonable practicability. Kim, we don't often get many cases about reasonably practical, okay?
No.
And for everyone, I know I drone on about what is reasonably practical, but reasonably practical is a standard of care. So you've got to have standard of care as you must do everything that's reasonably practical duty to prevent injury in a workplace, to have systems of work, all that sort of stuff. Reasonable practicability has four elements, which are, is there a hazard? So in this case, this was a helicopter landing in Antarctica to set up a field dump.
Yeah.
Okay. Hazard? Well, wind, weather, ground, risk of crevice. Okay, crevice is a hole that you fall through, which is covered by recent snow and you can't see, but you step on and you go straight through. So is there a hazard? What's the level of risk involved in that? Well, when there has been strong weather conditions in the Antarctic, there is a high likelihood there are crevices and the consequences are massive if you fall down. So death is the likelihood. So it is at the most extreme risk. What are the nature of the controls you've got to go to? And this is the heart of this case, which says, was this a detectable hazard? And this case starts saying, well, looking at the available information, it seemed a relatively safe place. The hazards were known about, and the methodology that was being deployed by this helicopter company and the Commonwealth who ran the site was based on current knowledge within the industry. So, look, there are hazards, but were they exercising reasonable controls? Well, to the extent that there is something known, yes, they were.
Yeah.
Now, the guy got out of the helicopter, walked across what he didn't understand was an ice bridge, and fell through into a crevice and died. And the argument of the regulator is there's a whole package of things you should do, including sort of satellite imaging, in this 14-day window where there was incredible weather conditions. And what the court said is that's just nonsense. This is not something that's reasonable. You cannot – reasonable doesn't mean every possible thing. It means based on the current knowledge and information that you have in that industry and the community, what have you done? And they did those things. But the package of suggestions that were suggested by the regulator was so extreme that no person could have done them. So I think it's a really good case. I don't want to take the foot off your throat when you're making mistakes, but there will things happen, even though you've got good systems that cause injury or death. That doesn't mean you're liable. But four elements: is there a hazard? That's something that's known about within your industry that was here. Is there a level of risk extreme? What are the controls you have in place based on industry knowledge, scientific knowledge throughout the world, not just here, of what they are applied? And are you allocating the relevant resources to ensure that those controls have integrity? All that happened in this case. So not liable.
Yeah.
Great case, a really good illustrative case of how safety law does work. What are we up to next?
Oh, we've got a poor
teacher, Japanese teacher.
So a Japanese teacher and brought students out, wonderful trip to Fraser Island. Sadly, two of the students died and the teacher was charged for failing to, failing to properly supervise the children.
Yeah, so they're exercising reasonable care to prevent injury to the person and themselves. This is a case, this is like Waikikiri we spoke about in a small way last week, where we talked about where you go to somewhere that's inherently dangerous. You've got a Japanese teacher coming to a place which is foreign to them. There is a water risk, a lake that exists there. There's inadequate risk assessment processes and an inability to exercise and control, and two kids drown. He ends up with a $55,000 fine. I suspect that's the least of his worries. But the point about this is when you are, and this is a great sort of school case for Outward Bound, but it's a great case for anywhere where you have an inherently dangerous workplace that you're attending, that you must have a risk assessment that properly determines the nature of the risk that exists.
At that place, though, not just generally.
Not just generally, at that place. Yeah. And you must have the proper controls. And in this case, supervision is not enough. You can't say, oh, well, you know, I told them not to swim. It's all too late. So sometimes the control is the word no. And this is a no case. And making absolutely preventing it from occurring. Anyway, look, a terrible case in some ways and unfortunate. Okay, we're on the Miller Logistics, aren't we, which is officer liability case.
Yeah, so this was an interesting case because the company was held liable, but the director was not for the injury that caused to the truck driver when he was hit by a forklift.
So this
this is the sort of stuff that you and Nina talk to our clients about all the time, about the steps that an individual must take to protect themselves under safety
rules. Yeah, so this was a due diligence argument against the director. Two forklifts collided, person seriously injured. There had already been a notice, improvement notice out around traffic management.
So five days earlier.
Yeah.
So the company went down.
Yeah, so all the things that puts the director on notice at risk. Okay. Now, what did this director do when you look at the five elements of due diligence that sit in all WHS jurisdictions and which are implied in the Victoria through Section 144? Did he have current knowledge? Did he demonstrate current knowledge of existing safety law? Most definitely he did. Were there safety systems in place that had integrity? Yes, there was. And did he require knowledge and understanding of those? Yes, he did. Did he require, in respect of any incident, and the third element, did he require the notification of breaches of those systems, and did he resource the correction and completing of those? And did he have the adequate resources around the entire safety system to provide a safe place? Yes, he did, and he documented every part. So what the court said is, no, look, this is a director positively taking strong steps to have an understanding and safety culture within the place. He cannot be charged. Now, how often do you and I say, Kim, documentation matters? Here is a person who demonstrated, not only through his force of will, but through the actions he took and documented every day, that he met his five elements of the due diligence test.
Well, that's the first thing the regulator goes to. Show me your documentation, doesn't it?
Yeah, and look, in Victoria, that's a Section 100 notice. Mm. It's Signal 155 and 172. That's where you go because they can't find anything out. The way they get their prosecutions is they put the paper down and go, you said you could do it and you didn't.
Mm.
Here they go, you said you could do it and you're pursuing it and you couldn't have known about everything because of the size of the business.
Yeah.
So, look, I think a fantastic case, but it comes back to documentation again.
Yeah.
Closing the loop, are we up to closing the loop, yeah?
Oh, I'm sick of closing the loop.
Yeah, sick of closing the loop. Well, this is number two. Oh, my gosh, I was sick of number one, but it's number two. I want to just deal with the big issues, and they're really around casual employment and independent contractors. Casual employment for major employers, which are over 15 headcount, 6 months' time, a person can notify they want to move from being casual to permanent.
Yeah.
Again, this is a really easy thing. We've moved from the law in the High Court, which was so sound, which says if I employ you under a casual contract, you're a casual.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone back to the test of what is the substantial performance of the role.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's the same with independent contractors. Mm-hmm. We've moved from the nature of what does the contract say, which is the time of entering into a contract, to what is the substantial. And does that employment methodology change during the course of employment? So this is a constant invigilation of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So can I just say to you, there is nothing magical about this. This just means, I employed someone as a casual and their role's changed. The awards are going to require you to review that. You are going to have to show now this substantial interference in business test for casuals.
Mm.
So it's not easy. It's not like the past clauses around conversion. That means when you go to employ a casual, you're looking at what are the needs of this person, of our business going forward. You're building the business case then, not later on, and you're engaging the person like a casual then and continuously. So you're demonstrating this person is not a permanent employee and you're saying why I don't need a permanent employee. Now, when you stick somebody on a roster as a casual and you employ them in the same way for 6 months, the evidence is overwhelming that they're a permanent employee. Mm. With an independent contractor, can I just say there will be an opt-out clause for people over a high income threshold, but the same test is going to apply. Mm. You know, who's controlling the nature of the work? If the person is slotted in as an independent contractor, as a quasi-employee, they're an employee. And, of course, the sham contracting arguments that now can be had before the Fair Work Commission where you're clearly underpaying someone against the award who's using them, you're dead. This is all about workforce planning. It's not hard.
Yeah.
The other closing loop stuff are the intractable bargaining and the variety of other small bits and pieces like the right to disconnect that we've talked about, which will be law in a few months' time.
Yeah.
Nothing new, nothing magical. These are the two really big issues I want you to think about.
Yeah.
Why don't we go on to the big issue for today? Yeah, okay. So, look, I guess we've got Makita's case to talk about, which is an offer of settlement that didn't get a cost reward at the end of it. So this is a general protections claim.
Yeah.
Person lost. They found that they were terminated because of serious misconduct. So there was a win for the employer. The employer had done a range of offers. There'd been counter-offers. They weren't that much different. There was one high one of 55, but then the difference was not much in between. But there was certainly a risk of the employer losing. And what the tribunal said at the end of it is, look, the threshold that exists under the Fair Work Act is that this is vexatiously refused to accept an offer. So that's a very high. That is, in other words, knowing an offer is being made, you make a decision which is so crazy as not to accept it. Well, that was not this case.
No.
Okay. But the analysis of it was, well, what is a good offer? And I reckon that's a really good decision because we're going to talk about Trier and Prodigy shortly, which is one of Val Gosnick's, the Deputy President's case that comes next. But can I say to you, just whipping out the template D, it's not a great idea.
Yeah,
sure. Saying $5,000 go away sounds good because it's a really powerful thing to say, but doesn't work. What the decision in this case said is you've got to look at what would the person be entitled to if they won.
Yeah.
You've got to look at where you're up to in the proceedings. What's the investment in the proceedings today?
The cost that incurred.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then you've got to look at the commercial risk of winning and losing, and you've got to add that as a multiplier or a divisor, if that makes sense, based on the case. In this case, there was no commercial reality around the risk of loss.
Mm.
So when the person was applying their mind to refusal, they entertained a reasonable basis believing they could win. So a bit of throwaway money wasn't going to cut it, so they didn't get their cost order. So here's our lesson. And I guess this is, I know I'm sort of preaching at you, but for those who work with me, I'll say to you, this is not a case that we will necessarily win. when we do a call to bank offer, which is done in contractual arguments or in superior court matters, that is an offer which triggers a cost outcome. When you're doing a formal cost outcome under the rules, the same things apply, which is you must identify the facts and the law you're going to win on in any offer of settlement, and you must win those. Because what you're saying to the person is, I am satisfied as a matter of fact, and when you get advice, you will be satisfied as a matter of fact. Based on the evidence that we currently hold, you will lose these things. And if you continue to proceed past that, given the amount of money I'm going to pay will properly compensate you for the investment of risk you're taking against the likely outcome if you were to win. See, that I'd like to say algorithm because it sounds clever, but it's not just a computation. If I don't put that in the offer, it won't work. And it didn't work in this case. So, please, it's nice, it's an empowering thing to say with a dismissive wave of the hand, $5,000 to go away or $10,000 to go away. It's more than you're going to get. But the person's already three parts into the litigation. They've already incurred $10,000's worth of costs. So the $5,000's not going to cover their investment to date, and they may have a chance of winning. So we're talking about the cost of investment. They've probably spent about $10,000. Remember, in plaintiff law firms, where they are paying, the costs are much higher than you would expect. Okay, and they're inclined to be fixed irrespective of what's going on. So they're in there. They've got contingent costs on settlement as well as part of that. So you've got to build that into the sum that you're doing. If they win, just say they would win 10 weeks. So say that's $20,000. Then you put in commercial risk and you say, look, we have three facts we might not get up, and if we don't get up on those facts, we lose. So our risk is high. It's at least at 50%. So you take those numbers and you say, okay, we'll build that risk into it by saying this is the total amount you could accept, but we say the risk of success are this, so we're going to knock it down by this amount. We've got a good offer, okay? We've got a good offer, and a court's going to look at that and they're going to see you are generous, sensible and thoughtful, and you'll get over the threshold then in the Fair Work Act, and in a call to bank, it will always win, and then under the rules, it will win in superior courts. Okay, so look, I just thought it's a good case. Trara and Prodigy's recent case by Val Gosnick, as I said, deputy president, where a deed was done at a conciliation or type of conciliation. It was done with lawyers involved, but it was contingent on some other protection, and there was an argument about whether there'd be mutual releases. So a deal was done as to money and stopping the proceedings, but was subject to a discussion around individual and mutual lease, and there was a shareholder action on the side that caused risk. So it didn't stop the proceeding. Okay, didn't stop it. Didn't release, didn't have any effect because there was no time for the release taking effect. Now, if lawyers can't get this right, your template that you have sitting on your laptop, you ain't going to get it right. And remember, there are very few circumstances where a pure deed is used. And often it's tried to be corrected by exchanges of emails and all those sort of things. Before you do a deal, the first thing you've got to do is, what is the time this proceeding is stopped? What is the action that I need to take? Is it a filing and discontinuance? What is the action that is taken that has done it? And that must be in the deed. Okay, it's not there, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Okay.
covered a lot of ground,
and we've still got time, which is excellent. Yeah, so I think with on our clock that you're staring at consistently, I think we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. So let's go to the problem.
It's not too bad. This one's case study. Shorter. Daniel was a finance director with Penguin Pacific, or PP. PP was a financial services and fund management business. Fast police recruiters headhunted Daniel for Hot Super, which was a major competitor of PP. At his meeting with HS's MD, Teresa, she offered Daniel the fund manager director role, which would report to her, a short-term incentive of 1% of revenue earned fees under management, and equity in 2 years if he grew the business by 15%. Daniel had achieved these benchmarks easily at PP. 2 weeks before he commenced work, HS received reliable intel that Daniel was a cultural nightmare. He used and shared cocaine with his subordinates, had 2 outstanding sexual harassment investigations, and lived a chaotic lifestyle. Under their contract with him, HS relied on the notice clauses to terminate his employment with the 3-month notice period allowed for under the contract. Daniel had provided undertakings as part of the offer of employment that he would disclose if he had committed any criminal wrongdoing or engaged in any conduct that would endanger his own reputation and the reputation of HS. HS advised Daniel it would not proceed with his employment as a result of evidence surrounding his past conduct, which said was inconsistent with the values of HS. Daniel issued Supreme Court proceedings claiming a breach of his employment contract and sections 18 and 31 of the Australian Consumer Law, Competition Law, sorry. Daniel's remuneration at PP was around $600,000 per annum. If he had succeeded at HS, it would have been $750,000 for the first 2 years, and after that with equity, north of $1 million per annum. So, questions?
Okay. So, the first question is, was Daniel's failure to disclose the nature of the things that are alleged against him retributory conduct that HS was entitled to accept? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, two parts to that. One is the conduct, and the second part is the undertakings that he gave. Mm. Now, the undertakings were towards criminal conduct or conduct that were damaged. Now, there's no evidence at all that they hold of that conduct.
No.
So, yes, we've got reliable intel. I don't back horses, you do, but we all get reliable intel and our horse runs last. So I want you to be very clear, when you put clause and undertakings in, you must put in, are you subject to any investigation or inquiry in respect of conduct?
Mm.
You got to do it right.
Yeah.
These undertakings wouldn't work. So first on, the undertakings don't work. The behaviour itself, so you and I have both dealt with cases where people failed to disclose criminal conduct when they were taking over senior roles, which involved the management of children and all that stuff. We've gone through it so many times.
Yeah.
That conduct can itself be reputatory because it can go to the heart of the – here, it's not great, and if it's true, it's bloody terrible. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it could be criminal conduct. But at the time of the receipt of that, we just don't have that level of evidence that you could satisfy yourself. And remember, you're forming a view – on something on less than the balance of probabilities, you're forming it on gossip.
Mm.
So, no, I don't think it amounts to repudiation.
No.
If there was hard evidence that came through, but can I say, Kim, this goes back to this issue, when you're employing very senior people, those reference checks better be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they can't be his best mate. They've got to be deep reference checks based around cultural values and performance and behaviours, because this would have been picked up if appropriate reference checking was done.
Yeah.
So that's the first question. Would Daniel have a good case against HS, Hot Super and Teresa?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer is not under misleading and deceptive conduct, which is the Section 18 and 31 competition law, because at the time of them representing the job and the time of them representing the remuneration, that was the truth.
Mm.
Now, remember, under competition law, misleading and deceptive conduct goes to the time of the representation. So this would be a very different case if he accepted the job, he was employed, and then he got there and found that he wasn't reporting to Teresa, that actually 1% of the remuneration was in a limited fund, which has never been successful, and therefore the representations around his entitlements. That would have been a breach of Section 31, and it would have been actionable, okay? And it would have been a very substantial claim, but that's not what happened here. So he's going to die on the competition law stuff. It ain't going to work. But on the breach of contract, he's got a really interesting argument, which goes back to Walker and Citibank case 20 years ago, because what he can say is, look, you relied on information. The contract itself says notice, and then it deals specifically with serious misconduct. Mm. You're not accepting me because you say there's misconduct that I had or the capability of misconduct. But even on that basis, it's not my misconduct while I'm employed.
Mm.
It's something I did before. So when you look at your contract, you can't say there's misconduct on my behalf, which isn't, because it's not misconduct while I'm working for you. Moreover, there's an implied term, you're going to take me as you find me. You can't just make shit up after you've done it. I think he's got a reasonably good contractual angle, but the damages are just terrible.
Mm. But wouldn't, in that case, they would have been better off saying to him, we're terminating your employment and just relying on the termination clause and not referring to
it. Not referring to it at all. The fact that they throw conduct into the ring puts it on notice that there has to be a reasonable basis for doing it.
Yeah.
And that's what the courts do in these cases. The law is pretty soft. Does that make sense?
Mm.
It doesn't have a lot of things holding it together. But when a judge looks at such a big contract, person's taken a huge risk moving one employer to another, it looks that you're forming a judgment of untested evidence to determine whether you employ or don't someone. But that is the reason for it. The court's going to go, you've induced this guy to leave his job.
Mm.
So he suffered the loss.
Yeah.
You formed a view based on evidence which is not reliable.
Mm.
No, I'm not going to do it. And it's that inducement to leave the job that triggers the next reasonless test that comes afterwards.
Mm.
So this guy's probably got a lifetime of work with this, in normal employee terms, of 4 to 5 years. is probably not employable because the damage you've done to the market and going around and making those inquiries in Australia is a small market. He may have a claim that's sort of $3 to $4 million. Yeah. So we thought it was worth just agitating this issue to show this is a risk that we see every day. So the last question, what would be a good offer of settlement in these circumstances? Mm-hmm. And the answer is a good offer of settlement would be one that looks towards a 6 to 12 month period on what would be reasonable notice, which provides you that level of protection, but with a real strength behind it that you're happy to pursue a deeper investigation. Mm-hmm. So you're keeping your lever really hot. At the same time, you are showing a level of risk understanding in the process.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Don't forget that we've got the Workers' Comp Masterclass that's coming up very shortly, which is on the 1st of May, and we are going to talk about this issue, particularly about the rejection of claims and the capacity of the safety regulator to look over the fence.
It's a very hot topic.
Okay. Let's show some thumbs up, guys. Kim needs as many thumbs up. She hates this stuff. It's lovely to do it with you, even though you weren't enjoying it. Great to see you. See you later, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.